South Dakota standards get a D+ from a prominent study. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday. It's July 14th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk about U.S. history, a planned social studies standards update, and how politics intersects with this entire conversation. That's central to today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation. We'll also hear insight about the battle over critical race theory and response from teachers and parents, SDPB's Josh Heyer reports. Plus, what does healing mean to you? South Dakota's artist laureate Dale Lamphere asked artists that question along with an invitation for collaboration. Dale Lamphere and some artists coming up later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. A judge's decision to release a victim's mental health records has the family asking questions. Attorney General Jason Roundsburg hit and killed Joe Beaver as he walked along a state highway. Roundsburg contends Beaver was suicidal and may have thrown himself in front of Roundsburg's car. SDPB's Ariel Zions has more.
The defense's theory is based on Joe Beaver's mental health history. They say police reports show he abused a drug before the crash that can cause suicidal thoughts. A relative also told law enforcement that Beaver was depressed and once mentioned he would throw himself in front of a vehicle to end his life. But another family member says the comments shouldn't be taken too seriously. Nick Nemec says his brother shared those thoughts with the prosecutor, hoping for harsher charges against Roundsburg.
The defense attorneys jumped on top of a statement made by a non-medically trained individual who lives 1,000 miles away and hadn't seen Joe in at least 9 months.
Nemec says the defense theory sends a negative message about mental health.
It's an insult to the thousands and thousands of South Dakotans who are taking medication for depression. Treatment of depression is way more common than a lot of people realize, and it should not be stigmatized.
Roundsburg is charged with 3 driving-related misdemeanors. His trial is scheduled for August 26 at the Stanley County Courthouse in Fort Pierre. For SDPB, I'm Ariel Zients in Rapid City.
The federal government reports the pandemic pushes more women than men out of their jobs. 400,000 more women than men left the workforce. Melody Shop runs a women's leadership program in South Dakota. She says the percentage of women in the workforce has not recovered. Shop says the pandemic has been especially tough on women because of childcare responsibilities.
And just the extra strain and the stress that brought on has been quite fascinating to watch. And it's interesting now as we're stepping back from it to try to remember. But I hope that we don't forget either about the impact that had on us. And so we take some good things away from that and we learn from that.
Shop says many women's responsibilities changed significantly when schools shut down because of the pandemic. Shop says communities should do more to support women who want to return to the workforce. South Dakota will receive an additional $127 million in federal COVID relief money to safely open and operate schools. The money comes on top of the $254 million the state got earlier this year. Mary Stodek-Smith is the Deputy Secretary of South Dakota's Department of Education. She says the plan for the funding is multifaceted.
So the 3 priority areas that we've identified are supporting strong instructional practices and educational opportunities for all students, addressing students' social and emotional needs and that mental health side of things. And then the 3rd priority area would be continuing to address issues of educator recruitment and retention.
Stodek-Smith says the department surveyed educators earlier in the year to help develop the funding plan. The data from the survey will help focus where the money will go. Today's weather report shows highs in the lower to mid-70s across the state. Lows today will be in the upper 50s. Tomorrow we'll see sunny skies with highs in the lower to mid-80s across the state. With SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. President Biden's American Rescue Plan is designed to provide relief to Americans and to stimulate the economy. The plan ultimately granted tribes authorization to use these funds to do the same in their jurisdictions. The Oglala Sioux Tribe went live recently with their COVID-19 Household Economic Assistance Program, which is designed to provide assistance to eligible tribal members whose households have been negatively affected by COVID-19. Today, we're going to make a little history of our own. SDPB's Richard Tubbles is joining me now for the first time from the Black Hills Area Community Foundation studio at Red Cloud in Pine Ridge. Richard, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. How are you doing today?
I am well. We're going to talk about this studio here in a minute. But first, kick us off to help us understand the efforts of the Oglala Sioux Tribe recently regarding COVID relief.
Yeah, so OST, the Oglala Sioux Tribe, passed an ordinance authorizing $2,000 to eligible enrolled tribal members, and this is regardless of them living off the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So Kevin Killer is the tribe's president and has been crucial, along with other tribal leadership, in pushing this agenda forward.
I think the biggest thing is just making sure that you're trying to be as transparent as possible, you know, and I think this coming into my administration, you know, making sure that we have weekly conferences, and we've been doing those Mondays or Tuesdays, depending on schedules and stuff like that, but just, you know, covering different things.
So Lori, you know, adult tribal members and their dependents who are also enrolled or who will soon be enrolled, they're eligible, and the process can be easy as doing it online, which is preferred. But if you don't have internet access or you're just that old school, there's still a paper application you can fill out.
I'd encourage online because you're, you know, it's a much easier option. I mean, the paper application could be intimidating, but it's literally the same questions that are online that are on the application. And in most cases, people on average have been taking about 4 to 5 minutes. And it's not that bad. You know, it's just yes or no questions.
All right, Richard, there are a few stipulations. What if a tribal member makes more than $75,000 or combined with their spouse more than $120,000?
Yeah, Lori, the tribe simply asks that they just provide proof of the hardship.
So, for example, if you had to buy exercise equipment because the gyms weren't open, because, you know, and it was over $2,000, and you made over $25,000 last year, just submit those receipts, and that will be enough proof.
So there's a lot of, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm talking with Richard Tubbles, and a little audio there from Oglala Sioux Tribe President Kevin Killer. Richard, there's a lot of money distributed. What are some of the financial safety measures the tribe puts into effect to make sure it gets to the right place?
Well, Lori, the tribe's leadership spent many meetings in regard to not only the application process, but one of the main topics included financial literacy.
You know, we had council members on there who are the chairs of our finance committee, who were one of the first ones, kind of explaining the process. Two is that we had Lakota Funds on there, you know, talking about how to open up a checking and savings account. You know, financial literacy is a huge thing in our community, so making sure that we find ways to keep resources in our money, especially if individual payments are going out. How do we keep that money circulating in our own economy?
So obviously, you know, the money is meant to stimulate the economy, but when you're in a rural setting, you know, places like Stratton or Rapid City, especially if you're from Pine Ridge, you know, you're going to go there to shop, eat, and recreate. But the tribe also has a plan for that too as well, Lori.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is this, you know, like we'll put out, we got a list compiled of native vendors, and we're going to start doing that and just keep distributing that. So, you know, at the very least, you know, use those native vendors as much as you can.
So Richard, President Killer has talked there about financial literacy, which I find so interesting. And right now we're in the throes of summer. We're doing a little summer school and SDPB for our spotlight. But the new school year is inching toward us. How does that intersect?
Well, you know, there's probably going to be a situation that, you know, with this money, it's probably going to be a one-time deal. And President Killer simply wants his people to think about the future and that of the next generation. So. Yeah. You know, this money could be used to buy school clothes, school supplies, and just stuff like that to get them ready for the school year.
Just think about your kids' future. You know, like go to Lakota Federal Credit Union. It takes $5 to open an account. You already have a check in hand, and it's easy, you know, and you're basically helping your kids think about the future by helping them learning about savings, learning about checking, you know, how business operates and all that kind of stuff, and really looking at ways to, you know, that go beyond, you know, your immediate needs and stuff like that. You know, and again, this is like most likely a one-time thing, so use it wisely.
That online application, that process started last week, and already they're seeing thousands of applications. That's not even counting the paper applications or written applications that might come in. So, Richard, what's next?
Well, President Killer has asked for the members to stay patient when it comes to the new enrollments, or as the enrollment office has been backed up by months due to the pandemic. And, you know, Lori, Ogallala Sioux Tribe isn't the only tribe doing it. You know, there's a lot of tribes like Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, Lord Brule, Crow Creek, and more. They're also doing something similar to stimulate their own economy.
Yeah. Okay, great reporting. So once again, Richard Tubbles, he's down in Pine Ridge right now. And again, you're the first voice that we hear from this studio, and it's being utilized in its first official capacity for In the Moment. Kind of an amazing thing at Red Cloud there in Pine Ridge.
Yeah, I couldn't be happier. You know, I look forward to our partnership, not only with the Black Hills Area Community Foundation, but, you know, that with Red Cloud Indian School. We are, we're still in the early phases of coming up with projects where we're going to engage and collaborate with students and get them to be interested in this thing that we do, Lori, yeah, on the day-to-day. And I really look forward to having their voices heard on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. So
it sounds fantastic. Thanks, Richard.
Yep, thank you.
Ahead on the program, we explore the debate over critical race theory, the notion of patriotic education, and how a new report says South Dakota gets a D+ for U.S. history standards. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. After a long pandemic break, Caribbean countries are now welcoming cruise ships back to port. The region depends on tourism, but COVID-19 is far from over. Many locals are unvaccinated, so public health experts say cruise with caution. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, a catalyst for creative and artistic expression in communities and schools throughout South Dakota. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artssouthdakota.org.
Walk out the door and your world changes. Dark to light, quiet to noise. The stars, the sounds of insects and birds, kids playing, waves crashing, cars passing. Even in our most peaceful moments, the world is always moving, changing. Something big is happening somewhere. Take NPR with you and stay connected to the world outside your door. Listen live on your phone, at this station's website, or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
Program funding by First Interstate Bank, reminding you that your home can be a great source of memories, as well as equity. For whatever you need in life, a home equity line of credit can help bring it all home. More at firstinterstate.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. At Sunday's CPAC in Dallas, Governor Kristi Noem reiterated her concerns about the threat of teaching students certain concepts she claims to be part of a Marxist indoctrination effort in the public school system. While some say the perception of a supposed Marxist indoctrination effort is resulting in an actual censorship effort by conservatives, SDPB's Joshua Heyer has this story.
Governor Kristi Noem says one of the biggest threats to America is the leftist indoctrination of kids in school. She highlighted her concerns during a recent speech at CPAC.
There are two things in this country that will destroy us faster than anything else. And the first one is the Marxist indoctrination that they are teaching our children in our schools. That will destroy this country.
But Noam's counter-effort has little to do with communism or Marxism. She's primarily focused on banning public schools and universities from teaching certain concepts about race and racism. A day prior to the anniversary of George Floyd's death, Governor Noam sends a letter to the State Board of Regents. She asked the board, which oversees the state's six public universities, to investigate any use of what's called critical race theory. It's a theory used to help understand how and why racial disparities still exist. Noam wants the board to investigate whether state funds are used for such teaching.
Critical race theory is not appropriate for our kids to learn and to have in our school systems. We want our honest history, our real history, our patriotic history to be taught to our kids so that we can continue to protect America.
Academic researchers who use critical race theory say it is not a history curriculum. They also say that there are nuanced criticisms of critical race theory within academia. But those aren't the critiques Noam and others are lofting. She says white children are being taught they are racist, black children are being taught they are helpless, and all kids are learning that America is evil. Stacey Morgan has been teaching third and fourth grade for decades. She's surprised this is getting so much attention.
And that's not what's being taught in schools. What we're trying to teach kids is just, in general, to be kind to each other, and we do anti-bullying things and, you know, just teaching children to treat each other the way that they would want to be treated. But we don't specifically talk about race or, you know, define our students into different races or anything.
Noam says students should not be taught the country's foundations were defined by race and slavery. She has proposed a $900,000 fund to teach students, as she says, why the United States of America is the most special nation in the history of the world, and signed a pledge to restore honest, patriotic education that cultivates in our children a profound love of country. These measures have some parents concerned. Christopher Hansen is a parent from Rapid City. He has two kids in public school and one who recently graduated. He has concerns about kids learning concepts they're not ready for, but even more, he's worried the nation's classrooms are becoming a battleground for the nation's culture wars.
I think it's a bit reactionary and dangerous of just going right down the other road into indoctrinating kids the other way.
Some state educators say Noam is taking on something that's extremely theoretical. Mel Olson recently retired after teaching history and social studies for about 40 years. He also served in the state legislature for 12.
Well, we know it's not an issue now, but gosh, it might be, and it could be, and so we should, you know, and that's ridiculous. Parents who are concerned about what their kids are learning are good parents. They should be involved in the school. But instead of just blindly throwing darts at a dartboard, they should actually visit a classroom. They should actually go to the school board. They should actually look at the standards. They should actually look at their kids' textbook and see what's in there.
Many educators say they handle topics of race delicately in their classrooms because it's such a high-profile issue. Alexander Lang is a history professor at Black Hills State University in Spearfish. Lang says some people see this as an effort to mislead students about our racial history. He's concerned that perception could result in a deliberate effort to use legislation to redefine civics education.
Education is not a place to be given any single narrative. And you know, I'm not really sure if that's productive for America and really helpful in really any way.
Some conservative legislators hope to address concerns about civics education during the 2022 legislative session. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Joshua Heyer in Sioux Falls.
This story is part of our July SDPB Spotlight. You can find it online at sdpb.org/spotlight. Well, let's widen the lens a bit now from South Dakota to the rest of the nation. Earlier in the week, NPR's All Things Considered explored a new evaluation of state civics and U.S. history standards. South Dakota, by the way, scored a C- in civics and a D+ in U.S. history standards, according to this report. So in case you missed it, here is the context from All Things Considered.
Now new insight into the fight over critical race theory and K-12 schools. Some families, mostly white, accuse schools of teaching children to be ashamed of their race and their country. Educators argue they're simply teaching the facts of U.S. history and say they're victims in a culture war drummed up by conservative activists. Into this fight arrives a new survey of states' history standards, and it says a lot about what kids are actually learning. NPR's Corey Turner explains.
Standards are a roadmap of a state's values, leading teachers to the historical figures and events that students should know. For this new survey, reviewers rated the U.S. history and civics standards for all 50 states and Washington, D.C., giving them letter grades, A through F, for things like depth and clarity. At the top, earning A's were Alabama, California, D.C., Massachusetts, and Tennessee. At the bottom, 10 states failed, including Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and 10 more scored no better than D's.
Unfortunately, what I found is that they tended to be broad and vague, not specific enough.
Jose Gregory has taught high school U.S. history for nearly 20 years and was one of the reviewers for the report, which comes from the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Though Fordham is a conservative-leaning think tank, a handful of experts all told me the result is nonpartisan and worth taking seriously.
I'm really worried.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries teaches history at Ohio State.
If you don't teach about race and racism in American history, past and present, I don't know what the hell you're teaching. It's not the truth.
Jeffries says the fight over critical race theory is essentially about how schools teach about race and racism. And that is deeply informed by what states do and do not include in their U.S. history and civic standards. Since Fordham's last survey in 2011, reviewer Jose Gregory says states' handling of slavery and Jim Crow, as well as early Native American history, has improved, though many state standards are still vague or disjointed.
I cannot teach students about the emancipation without talking about slavery itself, right? I cannot talk about civil rights and the movement for equality without discussing Jim Crow.
Stephanie Wager is past president of the National Council for the Social Studies, and she lives in Iowa, where the history standards got an F. The governor also recently signed an order there saying students should not be made to feel discomfort or guilt on account of their race. As a result, Walker says, history teachers there feel vulnerable.
They're just very scared. They don't know, you know, does this mean I can't, like, teach my unit on the Civil War and we talk about slavery as one of the causes? Like, what does this mean?
The same is true, she says, when Iowa teachers tackle the Constitution. How should they handle something like the Three-Fifths Compromise, which allowed states to count three-fifths of enslaved people, thereby increasing slaveholding states' political power?
I mean, how could you talk about that in any other way than to say, this was all about sort of white power maintaining systems of power?
Iowa standards don't mention the Three-Fifths Compromise, which could make it easier for anxious teachers to avoid it. On the other hand, Oklahoma, which got high marks for its standards, specifically says fifth graders should examine the Three-Fifths Compromise and understand how it helped to maintain slavery. As it happens, Oklahoma also passed a law which, like Iowa's, says students should not be made to feel discomfort based on race. The difference, though, is standards. Unlike Iowa's, Oklahoma standards offer a clear roadmap for teachers to follow the uncomfortable facts of our history. And that new law in Oklahoma, it includes one caveat. It does not stop teachers from following those standards.
And that story can be found on the NPR All Things Considered website. You can find more coverage of South Dakota history online at sdpb.org/spotlight. Ahead on the program, Dakota political junkies Mike Card and John Schaff tackle the topic of the battle over history is taught. We'll also talk about how the very recent history of pandemic shutdowns is being handled in the political spotlight. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
How long can an athlete perform at a high level while being an active alcoholic? On the next Fresh Air, former big league pitcher CC Sabathia talks about drinking heavily through 15 seasons, including his most dominating years on the mound, and about getting sober. His new memoir is called Till the End. Join us. this afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by TSP, an architectural, engineering, interior design, and planning firm rooted in and supporting communities across South Dakota. TSP's rich history provides the passion to make our communities better by design for another 90 years.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Program funding by the Laura Ingalls Wilder Pageant, celebrating 50 years this July. Events honoring our Dakota heritage. Concert by Native American rock band Brulé. Appearances by Little House on the Prairie cast. More at desmittpageant.org.
Listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem is defending her pandemic response and challenging other Republican governors to be honest about theirs. Two people have resigned from the state work group that is tasked with revising social studies standards in South Dakota, and the political battle over critical race theory continues. We are exploring these topics today for our Dakota Political Junkies segment. Mike Card is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota, and he's joining me now in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios. Hey, Mike.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
Nice to have you at the table here.
Yes.
Yeah. And John Schaff is Professor of Political Science at Northern State University in Aberdeen, and he's joining us from the Tom and Danielle Amann Foundation Studio at the Northern Campus. Hey, John, welcome back.
Good to be here.
All right. That was a really ambitious introduction for what we actually have time to talk about. So let's focus on the most important things. We're going to play a little bit of audio from Governor Kristi Noem at CPAC in Dallas from Sunday, where she took aim at fellow GOP governors. Let's take a quick listen to that.
We talk about rewriting history. Let's talk about rewriting history. We've got Republican governors across this country pretending they didn't shut down their states, that they didn't close their beaches, that they didn't mandate masks, that they didn't issue shelter in places. Now, I'm not picking fights with Republican governors. All I'm saying is that we need leaders with grit, that their first instinct is to make the right decision, that they don't backtrack and then try to fool you into the fact that they never made the wrong decision.
All right, Governor Kristi Noem says very clearly, I'm not picking a fight. And a lot of people said, oh, you're picking a fight with Ron DeSantis of Florida, because this is all about presidential politics. Mike Card, what do you make of her appearance at CPAC and her intentional address to this idea of who shut down what?
Well, I think it's very interesting that she would pick on the other Republican governors specifically. And not only that, but to accuse them of making statements that aren't fully true. Our governor, Governor Noem, has insisted that she never shut down the state or any portion of it. And yet there was an April stay-at-home order for vulnerable populations in Minnehaha and Lincoln County. Schools were closed. State employees were sent home. And I'm not sure that she wants to hold herself to the same standard that she's holding the other governors to. Mm. But this is all political. This is try to set herself apart from the other pretenders, contenders. Governor Noem, I believe in the CPAC poll, which was one of the first that included former President Trump, did not generate much attention. I didn't know whether that poll was taken before or after her speech. She comes across as cool, confident, and presentable. Those are great qualities to have in a political candidate. If I were advising a candidate, that's how you want to come across.
Yeah. John Schaff, what do you want to add to that CPAC appearance and this, you know, hey, you did close down your beaches?
Well, I noted that she said, in talking about a different topic, when she was talking about the teaching of history and stuff that you've been talking about already this morning, we may get into. And she said that she was the first candidate to sign the 1776 pledge. So she did not describe herself as first governor. She described herself as the first candidate. Now, candidate for what is the big question. And And I wonder if that was the signal. And so precisely when she talks in the pandemic reference, and she talks about closing beaches, she's obviously not talking about Oklahoma. she means that to be a shot at Ron DeSantis in Florida, because, you know, and as Michael points out, there was this straw poll, both one with Trump and then one if Trump doesn't want run. And neither of those did Kristi Noem fare very well. Yeah. And clearly, other than Donald Trump, the clear number two choice of Republicans right now is Ron DeSantis. And he's the number one choice when you take Donald Trump out of the equation. And so if she's thinking about running for president, that's the person that she's got to take down a peg or two. And maybe this is the first indication of how she's going to go about doing that should she try to pull the trigger on running for president.
Yeah. And then she also tweeted about elk hunting guns. So you say pull the trigger, and you can also watch her. You know, she's visiting South Dakota manufacturers, not just it, but she was picking out an elk hunting gun. And I just know, Mike Card, that the number one thing people – I know from experience that the number one thing people are asking is, does she have an elk tag? I can't get one, is what they're going to say. It's how hard to get an elk tag in South Dakota. So they're not really focused probably on the gun as much as they're wondering how to get their elk tag. So, well, let's talk about this idea of rewriting history, because that does go into what John Schaaf was talking about, the 1776 pledge. Her urging people, as she's the first candidate, two people have resigned from the state, task force that is looking at the planned, it happens every so many years, right, reboot of a curriculum this year at social studies. Two people before the recommendations have made to the State Board of Education have opted out. Those two people are conservatives. They're not talking about why they left yet. We should learn more about that in the future. It all kind of intersects. It's all separate things. What do you want to pull out, Mike Card, in the time that we have to really say this is the important seed we should be focusing on right now?
Well, the one thing that stuck out to me about the news reports that I saw about the two individuals who opted out is the committee deliberations are mostly over.
Right.
So they resigned apparently so that they wouldn't be affiliated with the report. So there must be something that didn't make it into the report, or something that did make it into the report. The teachers, the other educators who devised those standards, that these two individuals didn't want to be associated with.
Yeah. John Schaaf, anything you want to add to that as sort of, you know, opting out but not saying why they opted out yet?
Well, I can't. Reading people's minds is beyond my powers. So I can't speculate on that. But I will say that I'll be interested to see what the state comes up with. And it's inevitable, but perhaps a shame that our curriculum gets politicized. So we can't put everything that we want in a curriculum, and you can't teach everything that you want to teach in a curriculum. Therefore, some things have to be in and some things have to be out. And that's part of what politics is setting priorities. And so it's inevitable that's going to be political. What it doesn't have to be necessarily is partisan, and that's sort of what it's become. And so hopefully when these standards come out, that we can discuss them in a relatively reasonable way and think hard about how we educate our young people in history and civics.
Yeah. So I don't have a history professor in the room, but I have two college political science professors in the room. And when I look at the South Dakota report from the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, U.S. history, the standards get a D+, and in civics, the standards get a C-. C- is considered mediocre by this report. D+ is considered inadequate. And this is K-12. Again, these standards are currently being revised as part of a regular, and I have not spoken to anybody from the Department of Education about this yet, because I'm just unpacking what this report says this morning. It's one glimpse at a curriculum. However, from your standpoint as in higher education, I'm curious to know if the students that you see coming in from South Dakota have what you think is a rigorous and organized civics education, history education. Do you have insight, you know, to the incoming freshman class and how their education is going at the K through 12 level? Mike Card?
Well, I have two pieces of evidence, one of which is I teach a dual credit American government class, which includes students at the University of South Dakota and students in various high schools around the state. And as part of this class, I certainly see that those who have not had American government in high school don't do as well as the others do. I try to bring them up to speed. I certainly try to follow the standards because they are getting dual credit for both the high school course and the college course. The second one is I teach a course in state and local government, ostensibly for those who have had American government, and all of the students passed the citizenship test that the formerly known as the Immigration and Naturalization Service gives. The score was fairly low, but that may be a testing phenomenon more than their actual knowledge. But they all passed over 3 years.
Yeah. John Schaff, anything you want to add to that from the incoming freshman class at Northern that you've seen?
Well, I would say a couple things. One is that probably in my view, the reason that we've been graded low on our standards, if you take the look at the way the standards look today, not what's going to be revised, but if you know, went back a couple months and looked at them, the standards for civics and history education in South Dakota were extraordinarily vague. They set very broad goals on various subjects, yet there was nothing in there about content. Like, what are they going to actually learn? And that might be, I've not read the Fordham report, but I'm going to assume that that's part of what it is. And in my experience, you know, one of the things that we've got in South Dakota is the last time students are required to take an early American history class is in the eighth grade. And a buddy of mine says that's when they're not far beyond the draw a turkey with your hand stage of learning. And so you can go through your entire high school education. Now, some people do take early U.S. history in high school, but you're not required under current standards. You're not required. And you're not required to take a single U.S. history class at any of our universities. It's one of a smorgasbord of courses that you can take to fulfill a humanities or social science requirement. For example, at my university, there's something like 43 classes you can take to fulfill your humanities requirement, of which history courses are just one of any number you might take. Mm-hmm. And I find that my students really do struggle to have what I would say is what they lack is an historical imagination. Their view of the past is blinkered. They can't imagine that people would think or act differently than we do today, and partially because they're almost unaware of any event, you know, pre-Britney Spears. And so they have a difficulty imagining, you know, getting themselves in the head. What might an American founder have been thinking? Or what might someone during the Cold War have been thinking? Yeah. And they tend to read contemporary prejudices into the past. And they have a difficult time having the past speak to them. And maybe that's something that we can do in our history education is learning how we can learn from the past instead of us always taking the present and trying to teach the past what they should have thought instead of maybe learning what they did thought as if it might have something to teach us.
Yeah. I'll give you a little quotation here from the report, and it says, although the core South Dakota social studies standards are presented in a straightforward manner, the wording of many individual standards is vague or unclear. So I think that echoes your thoughts there. And again, it's the standards, not the content, not the curriculum. That's different. We'll reach out to the Department of Education to help us clarify what exactly those terms and definitions are. We're going to leave it here for now. You can find all our coverage on South Dakota History, all our conversations throughout the month. They're going to be tagged with the Spotlight tag, and you can find them at sdpb.org/spotlight. John Schaff, thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me here, and always good to be on with Michael.
Mike Carr, thank you.
Well, it's always good to be in the studio for the first time in a long time, and and also with you, John.
Let's take a moment now to honor inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. The enshrinement ceremony for the 2020 class of inductees has been rescheduled for September 10th and 11th. Jack Marsh has been a champion of First Amendment rights in South Dakota. He's also been a journalist his whole career. In 1998, he began working under Al Newhart and Charles Overby at the Freedom Forum. Later on, he founded South Dakota Newswatch. He joined us on In the Moment on September 3rd of 2020.
I was given the extraordinary privilege of helping to carry out the vision of Al Newhart and fulfill the mission of the Freedom Forum, which was really to try to instill in the American people a real appreciation for the First Amendment and all that it means. And the reason for having a free and independent press in this country is really it's to perform that watchdog role. Al Newhart and Charles Overby gave me the opportunity to carry out that mission of promoting the First Amendment on a national scale. So I ran a number of programs that promoted fairness and diversity in the news media, and ran a number of programs that really highlighted excellence in the media, ran several awards programs and others. It was certainly the highlight of my career. Al Newhart and Charles Overby gave me the assignment of trying to make a difference in the country to diversify the newsrooms of America. And so I took that challenge and was able to, along with others, we started several initiatives to encourage more Native Americans to pursue journalism as a career. And we did that over a period of almost 15 years. We worked on that, and it was highly successful. And to this day, if you look at the Native Americans around the country who are involved in journalism, a number of them got their start and received their training through programs that I had the privilege of helping to start and run. I would match the journalism profession with any other when it comes to the integrity and skill and performance of those who pursue journalism as a career.
That's Jack Marsh, 2020 inductee into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. The enshrinement ceremony for this class is September 10th and 11th. Ahead on the program, South Dakota's artist laureate Dale Lamphere is with us. We'll talk about a community tapestry of art and healing. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Ruby Sales was on the front lines of the civil rights movement, demonstrating for the right to vote. She says she is still fighting 56 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
So it goes back to the fundamental question, to whom does America belong?
I'm Audie Cornish. We continue our series on voting rights this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear a couple bands formed in the 1980s that recently reunited to make new albums. The Jazz Worms from Denver, Colorado, and the Lunar Octet from Ann Arbor, Michigan. We'll also hear music from a previously unreleased concert by Miles Davis during his final European tour in the summer of 1991. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility, advancing South Dakota's economy, creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Dale Lamphere is South Dakota's artist laureate. He's completed 60 major public sculptures, including the Basilica of the National Shrine in Washington, D.C., the Dignity of Earth and Sky sculpture standing on the bluffs of the Missouri River here in South Dakota, and the Ark of Dreams, also in South Dakota, and that spans the Big Sioux River in Sioux Falls. Ellie Larson is the Art Committee Chair at Monument Health, and they are both joining us today from inside the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio at SDPB's Black Hills studio to talk about the meaning of healing and its intersection with art. It's all part of a broader conversation about a sculptural piece called Community Tapestry. Dale Lamphere, always great to have you back on the program. Thanks for stopping by.
Well, good morning, Lori. I'm happy to be here.
Ellie Larson, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I want to start with you, Dale, and this question and sort of where this project begins, and then bring Ellie into this notion of, you know, working on this through Monument Health at a time when this project began. It was really, there was a lot happening to think about healing and healthcare workers and all kinds of things because of the timing of the project. But Dale, tell me where this all got started.
Well, it was about a year ago. Monument Health had just completed one of their major additions to the hospital, and they contacted me, and they were looking for ideas to place on a feature wall that was created in the architecture there. I went ahead and came up with some ideas, and at one point my wife encouraged me to involve the community artists in the project, share a little bit. She scolded me pretty heavily in that regard.
And time to do some collaboration. And that turns out to be a really exciting idea. And Ellie, tell me a little bit about bringing this collaboration into the space at Monument Health is about more than just filling a blank wall.
It is about more than just a blank wall. So that's kind of the approach with all of our artwork. And we've taken quite a focus on the artwork that we're hanging in our facilities and how that impacts our patients, our families, our visitors, and our caregivers. And just in doing a lot of research of how should we do this right, we've looked at evidence-based design that really tells us that our surroundings do have a connection to healing and patient outcomes and all of those things. So we've kind of rolled that out, but we wanted to take that further. We wanted to implement some of those mediums of art that are harder to put into healthcare type facilities. We have to think about cleanability and all of those things. So going beyond framed art, how could we honor some of those community artists and really create, more connections? We were creating those connections through photographs of the Black Hills and landscapes that are recognizable, and creating that familiar feel that created those connections we wanted. But we really needed a way to take it further and to involve more artists. And Dale brought this idea to us that, really checked the box for so many of those things. It brought in these other artists. It created this piece that really spoke of community. And then I think I'll let Dale give his great quote he gave us, but the moment he presented it and how it would all weave together, we knew it was definitely the right answer.
Yeah, Dale, go ahead.
Well, the great quote that she speaks of was just a thought that I had, that it really is the weaving together of diversity that creates the fabric of a community. And we put out a call for artists, and Monument Health and Ellie were just wonderful about this. I mean, they supported it all the way through. We decided that we would give any submission that we received, any idea we received, $100 just for sending it in. And I have to admit, some of them were straight off the refrigerator. But we sent them $100. Yeah. And we had 103 submissions.
Yeah.
And from that, the art committee and I selected it down to 20 that were actually created to be included in this community tapestry.
This tapestry.
And yeah. Those were well paid as well for their efforts.
Right, professional arts. We're going to bring two of those artists into the studio. Ellie, before I let you sneak out the door and give up your chair to some of these artists, give a little advice, you know, just from the conversations you had on the committee, for another town in South Dakota who's trying to kind of get this sort of effort started, is, you know, how do we fill our medical, our healthcare spaces with something that has deep meaning? How do we collaborate? What are some of the questions that you think people should start with?
You know, we really started with what are we trying to do, and then how are we going to do that? So going back again, just, you know, the evidence-based design and following those principles of guiding us of, you know we know we want to do art, what's the right art? And then bringing in the community. I can't tell you the huge reaction that we've had from using community artists. It's impacted in so many ways. I mean, we have patients come in that say, you know, my family member did that. We have caregivers with their own art hanging in the spaces. So I think those connections really are what makes it special. Each of the submissions that Dale mentioned, they came with a story of what healing means to me. So the artists were able to tell a story as well. I think that's probably where I would start, is how can you involve your community?
Yeah. We're going to let Ellie Larson, who is the chair of the Monument Health Art Committee, kind of sneak out of the studio. And in true South Dakota fashion, we're going to bring our artist in. But Dale, while they get seated and ready to go, let's you and I keep talking about this, this idea of the collaboration and what healing means to me, because you've been part of all these, large projects, Dignity of Earth and Sky, Arc of Dreams. They all have stories behind them. What does healing mean to you? Did you learn through this collaboration to answer that question in a slightly different way?
Well, I think the artwork itself is a good example of what I consider healing, and that is involving others in the joy of creation. Mm-hmm. It's something that I felt a real obligation as South Dakota Artist Laureate to do. I want to spend my time encouraging other artists, the next generation, anyone who's interested in creating, to do so. I really feel the importance of the arts. Of course, I would, having spent 52 years now doing it.
Yeah.
But it's something that defines the values of a society. It shows who we are and what we value and what our character is all about. So it's something I think that's very important.
And I'm kind of wired for story. So if I hear the story that an artist put into something when I visit the Arc of Dreams, it's got lights on, you're outside in Sioux Falls, there's all kinds of things happening there. But I always go back to that initial idea of the leap of faith in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think about what that means to me today. And it's always different. You know, where's my leap of faith? So I find I look at these things very personally as someone who doesn't, make art in that way or doesn't make visual art. And mm-hmm. I'm curious, we've got a couple artists with us now in the studio. Rapid City artist Brittany Poorbear's design for the community tapestry is traditional beadwork. Brittany, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to be here today.
And then we also have Desi Schoenweiss. She is a spearfish artist. She also teaches at Black Hill State University as an associate professor in the art department. And her work is oil paint on cradled wood panel. Desi, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you so much, Laurie. I'm happy to be here.
Brittany, Ellie was talking a minute ago about some of the challenges of bringing different kinds of art into the healthcare space. And this is a really unique treatment of beadwork as part of this big collaboration. Tell me a little bit about the piece that you created and your design.
So my piece, when I got the call, when Dale called my manager, he's like, he asked me, you want to do the beadwork? I said, yeah. He's like, okay, well, think of a design and, something in related to health. So I kind of sat there for a little bit and, I asked around and I said, what is a really good representation of health or good health? And everyone I talked to said the turtle. The turtle represents good health, longevity, I mean, it translates to so many things. And when I wrote it down, I was like, I want it to represent good health. But not only that, there's certain design around the border that represents the Black Hills. So that kind of, this represents where we are and who we are, you know, together. And with the dragonflies circling around the turtle, dragonflies are known to be messengers of prayer. You know, when you pray, they, and you see those dragonflies, they go up and they send those they take those prayers as well. So I wanted to include that as well. So it's kind of a little explanation of my design.
Where did you learn traditional beadwork? I mean, who are the people in your life who helped you become the artist you are today and continue to guide you?
I, as a young girl, I was always around people who beaded. I just never had the interest, but kind of as a teenager, I had two grandmothers that always were beading around me, and I finally said, hey, I want to learn how to do this. I want to make things for my family. And so they both together took the time to teach me how to bead. And you know, without those two, you know, they I wouldn't be able to learn how to bead. And just kind of from there, I've grown to know people who bead, and that's kind of how that is.
Desi, I was reading the story and the images and the motifs that you have in your piece as well, thinking about this idea of what healing means to me. Tell us a little bit about your piece.
Yeah, so when the call came out for what healing means to me, it was kind of interesting how timely it was for me personally. I had just gone through a pretty rare diagnosis and had major surgery at the end of 2019. So all of 2020, I was kind of recovering and kind of going through the process of recovery. And in 2021, when this call came out, I was, oh, well, let me tell you what healing means to me. And of course, as a visual artist, symbology means everything to me. I'm a sucker for symbology and artwork. Mm-hmm. And so I included a kestrel as sort of the main figure. A kestrel is, of course, a very independent predator, the smallest predator, but a very independent type bird. And the kestrel is sewing together four kinds of patterns. There's one of clouds, one of aspen leaves, another one that has kind of crosses, and then apples. And each one of those four patterns represent certain aspects of healing. So, for example, the crosses immediately reference, you know, medical help and medical assistance, because you obviously need that. The apples represent taking good care of yourself, right? You know, the choices that we make, healthy choices. The aspen leaves represent our family that we need, our connections that we need as a support network. And the clouds can represent either faith or hope, you know, that kind of looking forward to past this idea of healing. And the kestrel is sewing those things together.
This is such a nurturing conversation and nourishing for me, and I think for our listeners, that it makes me sad that we have to close it now. But I hope that you will all come back and talk about this more. I really appreciated going online to the Monument Health website and looking at each piece of art, and even if I couldn't be in the physical space yet, but you can see this in the Monument Health Hospital in Rapid City in their main lobby. Dale Amphir, Brittany Poorbear, and Desi Schoenweiss, thank you so much for being here with us today. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.